Hey, I'm Jane Lindholm. I'm the host of Vermont Edition, and I'm just popping in to tell you that this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. In his State of the State address, Governor Phil Scott said Vermont is facing a major demographic crisis. The number of young workers is declining, while the number of Vermonters over 65 is expected to increase by 50% in the next 10 years. That's the baby boom generation reaching retirement age. Scott says it'll be very difficult for both state and local government to function effectively in the future if this trend is not reversed in the coming years.
If we don't break this cycle, our institutions, including state and local government, won't be able to afford what they currently do or what they would like to do in the future because costs will continue to rise much faster than our tax base can sustain. My friends, this is what a demographic crisis looks like.
The governor says there's no magic bullet to solve this crisis. Rather, many steps need to be taken to reverse the loss of young people in Vermont. What are some of the governor's key priorities to deal with this issue? This is one of the many topics we'll discuss today with Governor Phil Scott. Governor, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Governor, let's start off talking about this demographic crisis. You know, a number of Democratic lawmakers told me after your speech that they felt you did a very good job identifying what the problem is, and they feel the state is facing a crisis. But they say they don't see any bold plans to deal with this issue. They think you're taking kind of a piecemeal approach, and it's not going to work to reverse current population trends. How do you respond to that criticism?
Well, again, I'm very thankful that they've come to the conclusion, as I have, the demographic crisis is our largest challenge that we face as a state. And doing something about it is something we've done over the last couple of years and continue to do. With some of our key initiatives. And economic development is going to help in many different respects. Some of the actions taken on the worker relocation programs and the remote worker programs and so forth are going to help. Elimination of the income tax on military pensions, I think, would help. We're one of only eight states that continues to tax pensions, military pensions. So it prevents them from coming home or coming to Vermont to live. So there's a lot of different initiatives. There's not one single answer that's going to rectify the situation we find ourselves in, but there are many steps we could take. And I look forward to their ideas as well. I haven't heard many of them, but I look forward to some of their ideas. The remote worker program was their idea, and I was skeptical at first, but it's been beneficial. The return on investment, I think, is about 2-to-1 for our $500,000 investment in that. We have to continue to work on some of the initiatives that we know are working for our state as well. Tourism is one of our top industries. Putting more money, $500,000 more into marketing tourism, I think is important, as well as marketing some of the other attributes that we have, whether it's in our state parks or our fish and wildlife licenses or our fishing licenses in particular. We're seeing declining sales in that area, but we take advantage of some of the attributes we have, our environment and so forth. So there's no one single answer. Again, no one bold action that can be taken that I believe will rectify the situation. But if the legislature has one, they shouldn't be silent. They should come forward and let's talk about it so that we can, again, work on this together.
So as you look at all your various proposals, which one do you think holds out the most hope of having the biggest impact?
Oh, again, I think all of them, that we can't do focus just on one initiative. We're going to have to continue to foster the economy. We have to continue to invest in our downtowns and village centers by using tax credits. We have to continue to look at housing stock. You know, we took that bold action, the $37 million housing bond, which has had a beneficial result. We have about 800 units that we put online or will be online in the next year or so. I think 600 have been built to date. So that will help. Act 250 reform, I believe, will help. TIF districts, I think, will help. The tax increment financing that Chittenden County, Burlington has taken advantage of a couple. Chittenden County has benefited from this over the years. I think it's time for the rest of the state to be able to benefit as well, whether it's in Bennington with the Putnam Block or Springfield or wherever. I think that these can be beneficial for small communities, too.
We got this email from Peter in Moortown, who wrote us, is it time to admit that your, this is to you, that your focus on overall austerity and no new taxes and fees is not working? No one is moving here in droves. Families need help. Communities are fighting over school closures. Our climate needs attention. When is it time to admit that a robust system of social services may actually be the better plan for the future of our state?
Well, I appreciate the comment, but I'm not sure that a knee-jerk reaction to just increasing the burden on already overburdened Vermonters is the answer either. We hear every day about people leaving our state. In fact, there are more people leaving the state than coming in. We have a demographic crisis that we have to face. We have more births, more deaths than births in this state. And I don't, you know, I find very few people out there. The vast majority of people that who I talk with say, you tax us enough. What we need now is more taxpayers. We don't need more taxes. We need more taxpayers to pay into the system. We've lost 18,000 workers since 2009. That's part of the problem. So I don't believe increasing taxes is going to incentivize and bring more people into the state. I would bet that there's not many people that would buy into that concept.
Let's go to our callers and start off with Deb, who's calling from Burlington. Hey, Deb, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you, Governor. I just wanted to speak out and urge you to reframe some of the language you use about characterizing this, quote, demographic crisis. You really frame it like it's a huge problem that our population is aging. It certainly is a problem that we don't have younger people moving in. But having older Vermonters contributes much to our state, and older Vermonters work. The vast majority of them work. They do volunteering. They're raising kids in place of the kids' parents who have their own problems. So that's a big issue. I mean, I think that you need to reframe the way you talk about this and recognize.
Well, Deb, I appreciate that. I would ask maybe you could tell me how to rephrase what we're trying to get across to people, that we do have an issue and we need more youth in our state. I have a great amount of respect for our retirees, and we want to protect them. Many of who I talk with aren't choosing to work. They have to in order to pay the taxes. And the previous email that Bob had read suggests that we should be taxing more. And I would ask you, should we be taxing our retirees more? We reduced the tax on Social Security and eliminated that Social Security in the state for low and moderate income Vermonters. And I thought that was a step in the right direction. But maybe you could tell me, how should we rephrase this so that we get the point across that we have a demographic crisis on our hands?
Well, I think you're exactly right. What you just said, we need to bring younger people in. And that's where you need to talk about it and how you're going to do that and how we're all going to do it. Bring in businesses that pay livable wages. Everything you're talking about in terms of housing. The crisis isn't so much that we're getting old. It's that we don't have people coming in and staying.
No, you're right. You're right, Deb. Yeah.
Deb, thanks very much for your phone call.
No, I appreciate the phone call, because sometimes the phrases that we use and I use give the wrong impression. And again, we're very fortunate to have so many retirees in our state, because they do a lot for our economy, a lot in terms of what they've done previously. We need to make Vermont more affordable, I believe. We need to attract and welcome more refugees and legal immigrants. I think that's part of the answer. Part of my budget created incentives to retain graduates with nursing degrees, because we have a shortage of nurses throughout the state. They're saying about 4,000 that we could use today. Many traveling nurses in some of those companies, out-of-state companies, are filling the void that we have, but they're very expensive, which leads to increased prices for healthcare. So doubling the apprenticeships, I think, is important. I mean, just trying to put more people to work. Again, 18,000 fewer people working today than in 2009. We're not moving in the right direction.
Let me read you an email that we got from Jim, who wrote us, "I wish someone would talk about the death of the middle class in Vermont. It's an epidemic for people like myself who want to raise a family where they grew up but can barely stay afloat financially despite making $100,000 a year. Healthcare premiums and huge debt from our high deductibles is to blame. He actually has a breakdown of all his expenses in terms of mortgage, healthcare, car payments, utilities, credit cards, and ends up saying, why can't someone do something for the middle class? And, you know, when you look at something like property tax burdens in Vermont, and for the folks who don't qualify for income sensitivity, they're just over that threshold. I don't know where it is, if it's at $95,000 or $105,000. But the folks that are just over their line, they pay the highest percentage of their income for property taxes of anybody in the state of Vermont. Is that group really getting whacked?
Yeah, well, I think what you'll find is that there's more in that group, the middle class, than every other sector in Vermont. So they're carrying the burden for a lot of the expenses in the state. Take a look at, you know, education in particular. We spend this year, we forecast based on some of the forecasts from the districts, the school districts, that we're going to be spending $1.8 billion for education. Meanwhile, the student population continues to drop. It dropped from last year. So that's an $87 million increase since last year. So $1.8 billion, $87 million more. And they've tried to, the legislature, we've tried to work with them, taking the burden off from property taxes. But we're getting benefit from some of the other tax, sales taxes and so forth. So we need to get our costs under control in that area. The single largest expenditure, I believe, in state government, $1.8 billion. And that goes unfettered. We're not doing enough to try and bring in costs there. And something I talked about in my first 2 years, the legislature didn't seem willing to go along with some of my initiatives. But again, we need some help. And I'm not seeing too many ideas on how do we control like that $87 million increase from happening.
Let's take a look at healthcare, which Jim brought up in his email. For people who sign up for healthcare on Vermont Health Connect, if you're up to a certain salary, you get a healthcare subsidy. If you're over that salary, then you pay the full premium. I mean, is it time to reassess where we draw these lines?
Yeah. Well, again, I hear the same thing with property taxes. I hear, we just need to redo the property tax system so that we take the burden off from property taxes and put it in other areas. And my approach is we need to get a handle on the costs. And it's the same with healthcare. It's not just how we pay for it and what taxes we pay, but the costs associated with that. So I understand the cost of healthcare is a huge challenge for businesses and workers. But there's, I also know there's no easy fix or political promise that will change that, right? It's going to take hard work. And so our approach has been about payment reform that pays providers based on the quality of care, not the quantity. That's the Accountable Care Organization or One Care or the ACO. And we're making this transition. We're trying to prove ourselves along the way and using our Medicaid population as a testing sort of for this this new type of system that we're working with the federal government on. And there was a seminar right here, a get together yesterday. 175 people attended right here in the Capitol Plaza yesterday morning. And we're making some gains in that area. We're trying to bend the curve a little bit, and if you look at the data, and since this payment model was introduced, we spent $7.7 million less in 2018 with those who were had adopted this model. And on the other hand, providers that are paid by the state who are not paid through the ACO spent about $1.5 million more than expected. So we're seeing some small marginal gains in this area. It's not the total answer. But we need to, again, focus on every area. How can we control costs? Education, healthcare, wherever it is, we need to control costs. Because we're spending enough money. We just need to do it more efficiently, more effectively. And we can't just have this knee-jerk reaction of every time we have a crisis of some sort that we just raise a tax. We have to live within our means and find, prioritize, and figure out what do we want to live without in order to solve the problem that's before us.
Let's turn to Kevin, who's calling from Burlington. Hi, Kevin. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you. And thank you, Governor, for bringing up One Care Vermont. I was at that presentation with you yesterday at 7 o'clock on that cold morning with all those key stakeholders. And I just wanted to, impress upon our listeners that One Care Vermont really has made a significant difference. I'm a healthcare provider. I've worked in the emergency department for 20 years, and I've seen things in the last few years that I hadn't seen in a lot of years. And it's partly responsible because it's switching from this pay-for-service model that where we always look at something as if we can get reimbursed for it. And things that you don't get reimbursed for that can really make a difference are addiction counselors in the emergency departments who can get patients on opioid replacements, right in the ER. We've got social workers and care managers that can help people through their chronic disease problems. That really makes a difference.
So, Kevin, it sounds like you feel this change, getting away from fee-for-service, is a good idea.
You know, I don't know the answer to that, but it seems that it certainly is making changes that I see that aren't based on pay, that aren't sponsored by pay-for-service. You know, I think it's. There's a lot of moving parts, and it's pretty complicated. The pay-for-service model just isn't working. You know, it's just not working. And right. With our aging population, it's just going to get more and more expensive if we stay on this. It's not a tenable course.
Okay, Kevin, we certainly appreciate your message and your phone call. Governor, you see the One Care system is really providing a different payment philosophy.
Yeah, it's based on the quality of care versus the quantity of care. You know, the fee-for-service model is what we use now, right now, and we're looking at trying to provide the health of the patient more holistically, more communications. And one of the presenters yesterday talked about this a little bit, and they had this model in Maryland. And he said the system, the fee-for-service model, is based on the sicker you are, the more you're paid. So there's no incentive in some respects. It's perverted in a way. There's no incentive for people to make you healthier because you get paid less. So with this model, trying to pay for the health of the patient, regardless of how much service you use, just trying to make you healthier. So I'm trying to come up with some analogies for cars and so forth. I'll come out with those at some point. But if you bought a car, let's say, and the dealer said, I'm going to include tires for the rest of the life of the vehicle, and I'll continue. I bet they would have you come in and have an alignment done every 6 months or so, because they had to take care of the tires. Otherwise, they don't really care how many tires they sell through the life of your car. So it's the same kind of thing, different approach to healthcare, and I think it has some promise.
As you know, the U.S. Senate is doing an impeachment trial of President Trump right now and will decide later today whether or not to call witnesses. You've said you think additional witnesses like John Bolton ought to be called. It looks like that's going to be unlikely, but who knows? There may be some Republican senators who change their minds at the last minute. But if they don't, based on the information and the evidence and testimony that you've heard so far, If you were a member of the U.S. Senate, would you vote to impeach the president?
Well, obviously, I'm not a member of the Senate, and they have a tremendous burden on their shoulders at this point in time. I think it's important for the good of the country, and it's important for the process that we have faith in that process and trust. But if they don't call witnesses, I think that that in itself sends a terrible message for the future, that we should take this seriously. It shouldn't be taken lightly. This is a dark time in history in some respects, but we need to make sure that we have all the facts, let the American public hear and see all the facts. And whatever they do, whatever vote they take after that, they'll have to live with. But if we don't have the facts presented to us, that we'll always be suspect of what's out there. And again, we'll lose faith and trust in the system itself, which is really integral to who we are and what we do. So I'm very concerned about this. I'm hopeful that they'll do the right thing and vote in favor of allowing more witnesses.
You know, it almost seems like the president's lawyers agree with the basic facts in the case that the governor, the president,
easy.
Yes, that the president may have mentioned the fact that he wanted an investigation into Joe Biden in order to release the military aid. And his lawyers seem to say that's not an impeachable offense. Maybe it's not what should have been done, but it's not impeachable. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think it's a terrible to think about that. What if it was governor? What if someone was governor, let's say, and then they utilize their position to gather evidence against someone who is going to be running against them in the future, and they use their position in office to do that, to hold the certain, you know, a road or whatever it is in certain areas in order to get that information. That wouldn't set right, I don't think, with Vermonters or any state citizens of the state. So I just think it's plain wrong. And if nothing else, there should be some, you know, there's got to be some penalty for that, because it's just not conducive to the presidency and what we expect out of our presidents or any leaders for that matter.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Madison, who's calling from Burlington. Hey, Madison, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. Pleasure to speak with all of you. Good afternoon, Governor Scott.
Good afternoon.
I'm calling. I've been living in Vermont for 30 years. I'm a military kid who landed here after college. And half that time, I've actually been working remotely for technology companies, primarily e-commerce. And what I would love to see, as someone who's been importing income into the state, is actually a better job promoting Vermont as a technology destination. As a technology destination, but also a place that if you move here for one company, don't worry, you'll be able to find another job, because Vermont has a very strong technology base. I don't think we're doing a good enough job promoting that. People know us for our cows, our ice cream, and our maple syrup, and our lovely just rolling hills, that they don't really know the tech hub that is Vermont.
I think it's a great point. We need to pull all our levers, and I do believe that we have a thriving and continuing to have, I think, a future in tech in particular. And I thank you for working remotely and coming to Vermont. But it has to be affordable at the same time. And we have to create, we have to understand that we're competing with other states. That's why some of my budget reflects on what it is we can do to incentivize businesses coming to Vermont, and in particular in the climate sector. I'm advocating that we have some tax credits in order to bring and welcome some of these new technology companies around the battery energy storage sector. As well as let's really incentivize and say no corporate tax for those who are coming here to help us see our way transition through to zero carbon community and society. So I think energy storage, I think, is really the area from a climate perspective. That's a game changer for us. The more we can do with batteries, the more large scale energy storage, the more renewables make sense. So let's benefit from both sides, a better climate, as well as a better economy in doing so. But I take her point, and I agree. We should be doing more to promote what we're doing well and to build upon that, because I think that we have the capacity to build out our tech sector. But those tech companies as well look at all the taxes associated, whether it's property taxes or income taxes, corporate taxes, and so forth, and they make decisions on where they decide to make have their footprint. So we have to keep that in mind as well. It has to be cost effective for them to do that.
We've gotten a lot of emails and calls about climate change. There are a couple of different proposals at the State House, as you just mentioned. You think that battery technology is going to change over the next 5 or 10 years and be really dramatic, to where maybe a charge will last 600 miles. And you have faith and hope in technology to do that. There are a couple of other proposals because there are some people who think that your plan really doesn't go far enough.
Well, our EVs and so forth, and trying to promote the infrastructure, building out our infrastructure, charging infrastructure, I think is important. If we're going to have more EVs, we need to make sure we have places for them to charge, right?
Right.
And I see that technology is changing. I use the example of the Ford Mustang, the 450 horsepower motor. It can go 0 to 60 in about 3.3 seconds, and without all the maintenance to go along with it. No radiators, no belts, no changing the oil, no transmission fluid. They will be easier and less expensive to maintain in the future. That's part of what I see. And I believe within 20 years, we'll be seeing, whether it's EVs, I think it's going to be mostly electric, but it could be hydrogen by then. But within 20 years, I don't believe we'll see any, or too many, at least in the automotive industry, too many cars made with the internal combustion engines. It'll be electric.
So there's some people at the State House who feel like Vermont cannot wait 10 or 20 years for the solution. It needs to be dealt with now. One proposal has been called the Green New Deal. It would raise as much as $100 million to do many of the things you want to do, but do it with a much faster time frame and a much larger commitment. The lead sponsor of that bill is Washington Senator Anthony Polina.
I think people are beginning to see that we have to start making the investments necessary to actually deal with climate change, meaning we have to really fund weatherization, we have to really fund electric vehicles, we have to really fund public transportation. You know, we've done that on a very minimal basis, but now we have to start being very serious about it.
Senator Polina's bill would apply an income tax surcharge on wealthy Vermonters who have benefited very much from the recent tax cuts in Washington. What about that sense of urgency that we don't have 20 years to wait on this?
Well, again, these are tax proposals that are coming forward from the legislature. Maybe you can tell me, Bob, what are they doing? My proposals have been about infrastructure, EVs, incentives, trying to grow the battery storage technology sector, weatherization that we do right now. I would venture to say, how much do you think, Bob, we spend today, right now, today, in this last budget year, on weatherization?
$25 million.
Well, that may be what we should be spending.
Okay.
But it's $11.7 million that we're spending today on weatherization. We weatherized 800 homes over the last year through our designated agencies like the Capstone and so forth. So we're doing a lot right now. But my point is, what is it that the legislature is proposing that we do? What are their initiatives that really put their money where their mouths are? What are we doing? I hear a lot of tax proposals, but I'm not hearing what it is we're supposed to do with that money.
If Senator Polina was sitting here today, he would say 800 homes have been weatherized last year. That's a great start. But you know what we need to do? We need to do 10,000 homes a year, because if you do it 800 a year, it's going to take forever to get around to all the homes that need to be weatherized.
Yeah. And I'm saying, in fact, I said that we should be taking part of the surplus. If we have a surplus at the end of the year, we should be taking part of that surplus instead of putting it, we take half of it and put it towards our $4.5 billion unfunded liability with pensions, which is part of what we've been doing. But the other half usually goes to the rainy day fund. And I'm saying, let's take half of the rainy day fund money, extra money, and put that towards weatherization, for instance. That would give us another 800 homes. Those 800 homes, we're saving, almost 2,000 tons of carbon in doing so. So it all adds up, and if we do it every year. But again, my point is, what is it? We should assess what we're doing today, right? We should assess what we're doing today. We should then determine what we need to do in the future, and then determine how much that's going to cost, and then determine how we're going to pay for it, much like we did with water quality. Let's have a plan. I mean, I'm not seeing a plan. I'm doing something. I'm promoting something. And they're saying that's not bold enough, but I don't see anything that they're proposing that would do anything of any substance. It's just taxes.
If you did that evaluation, much like you said you did with water quality, and you came to the conclusion that it was important to really step up the number of houses that were weatherized, and we had to have many, many more charging stations for electric vehicles around the state, if that was the conclusion of that evaluation, at that point, would you consider using some tax revenue to pay for those programs?
Within the structure, the confines of our what we're spending today, we're spending $6.3 billion for our budget. I would say that we could find a way to do that. Because you remember with water quality, that was some of the debate over the last couple of years. The legislature decided they wanted to raise a tax in order to pay for the last portion of the Clean Water Initiative. And I said, I don't believe we need to do that. I believe that we can do that within our existing resources. If it's a priority, let's find the money and let's do it, because I think it's that important. But I think we can do this. Well, at the end of the day, we found an existing source. We were able to agree on that. And we're moving forward, and we're spending $50 million a year for water quality. I think we could do the same thing here within the constraints of what we're spending today. We have to prioritize. Not everything is a crisis. There's a difference between want and need. And I believe climate change is real, and it's something that we should be putting a lot of effort in. And I'm doing that, and I'm promoting that. I think that we just need to have a plan. You know, when I'm building in the construction industry, I don't just figure out, set some goals about what I wanted to do without having a plan on how to get there or how to build the building. I have to have a plan in order to know what to do and how much it's going to cost and how we're going to do that. It's just the way my brain is structured.
Let's talk to Asa, who's calling from Middlesex. Hi, Asa. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Governor Scott. I'm actually calling from Middlebury. I'm at Middlebury College, but I'm from Montpelier. And I was just talking to some of my other friends from Stratton and Brattleboro. So we're all young Vermonters, the sort of people that you're worried about leaving the state, and talking about your climate policy, and specifically your kind of reticence on the Global Warming Solutions Act. And what we've noticed is that a large majority of people our age are very concerned about the climate, and that while you talk about keeping us in the state, your actions of delaying on climate action and then going to such false solutions that have almost, for example, the Ford Mustang has almost become a joke among many of my friends, because it's so ridiculous to expect that an electric Ford Mustang is a reasonable climate solution. So
I would ask you, though, I mean, we're using that as an example. I'm using that as an example as why I'm excited about the new EVs, but you could use a Nissan Leaf. You could use any other Tesla, anything else you want to use as an example. But I get the feeling that you don't think EVs are the answer to our future.
Well, I think they're part of it, but I think you're being offered solutions right now. Transportation Climate Initiative, you've got the Global Warming Solutions Act. Even before Polina's bill, which is a slightly more radical solution, the Global Warming Solutions Act is such a low baseline for you to refuse to sign.
What action? Well, it hasn't been passed by the either body, by the way. It hasn't even got out of committee. So I haven't said I've refused to sign something. I don't even know what it is because it hasn't even got out of committee. It hasn't even been taken up as far as I'm concerned. It has to get through the committee, then go to the floor of the House or the Senate, and then go over to the other body. So I haven't ever said that I'm not going to sign it. I'm just saying there's got to be another way. I mean, I need a plan to do it. And I'll ask you, what action is this bill proposing other than a taxing mechanism?
It's not at its base a taxing mechanism. Essentially, it holds the government accountable for our climate bills or climate goals right now, holding us to the Paris climate goals that you said we would stay with. So really, it just makes it so that the citizens of the state can hold you and the rest of the government accountable. And it is
so no action at all.
No, that's why I'm saying it's the bare minimum. So even if you even won't commit to signing something that barely holds us to these goals, how can we expect you to take any real action? I don't think you're taking this seriously.
Well, I'm taking it more seriously than I've seen anybody else take in terms of action. You know, I put these things into place. We built out our charging infrastructure. We're going to build out more in my present budget. We had incentives for EVs last time. We have more incentives this time. I'm saying we take some surplus and put that towards weatherization. We're doing weatherization within my budget as we speak. I think it's disingenuous to say that I'm not doing anything. I would ask, what action is anyone else proposing at this point other than goals that where we can, you know, if we don't meet them, we'll just get sued and that money will be used up by attorneys and so forth fighting a lawsuit. What is it that what bill is proposing to do actual tangible things?
Asa called in talking about the Global Warming Solutions Act. If I understand that legislation correctly, it does set up targets for the state to meet. It puts it into law, so it's not a recommendation. It's a statutory requirement. It calls for a reduction of 26% of carbon emissions by 2025, 40% by 2030 and 80% by 2050. If those goals are not reached, it allows citizens to sue the state to say, yes, you have to take steps to do that. And if that lawsuit is successful, it's my understanding that there would then be a task force put together that would make recommended changes in order to meet those goals.
Yeah, just what we need is another task force in Montpelier. What we need, I believe, is action. We need a plan. I don't mind the goals. I mean, I think in some respects, that's fine with me as long as we have a plan that puts us on that course. So let's work together, much like we did with the water quality. Let's come up with a plan that gets us to where we want to go. And you can put the goals along the way, but it has to be something in its entirety. I think there's an opportunity to find common ground here. But I think the bill has a long ways to go in order to do that. And again, if this legislation could focus on the same approach we took with clean water or learn from clean water, let's not wait to get sued. Let's take action and do what we need to do so we don't get sued. And let's not just put arbitrary goals out there without a plan in place.
So I'm sure there are people listening who feel like sometimes government doesn't respond to a situation until there's a crisis, and then it deals with it. And what they're trying to do, and they may feel there's a crisis right now with climate change, and that these goals are a way to hold the government, state government, accountable. It's a way of saying, you better come up with some plans because we're putting these goals into law, so it's going to force you to deal with this issue.
Not me, future governors, future legislators. But isn't it incumbent upon us to take action and come up with a plan ourselves, come up with some sort of blueprint on how to get there? I mean, I fail to understand just setting these arbitrary goals out there that we don't, and we're gonna leave it to others to figure out how to get there. I mean, the lawsuits might come 3 or 4 or 5 6 years from now when we're not there, and then somebody else is going to have to deal with it. Why don't we deal with it now? Why don't we come up with a plan and figure out how to get there together?
And some people might think, why can't you do both?
That's what I'm saying.
Well, why can't you set a plan and set the goals at the same time and have the plan work towards reducing the goals?
That's what I'm saying. Come up with a plan. Incorporate the two. Incorporate what we did with clean water. You can put the goals in place within the legislation, but have a plan as well to see how we get there, and be realistic about it, and let's get there together, and let's not wait for a lawsuit. I think just coming up with these goals and statute without a plan sets us up for failure.
So if I'm understanding what you're saying correctly, you would support the Global Warming Solution Act and the goals that it includes as mandates as long as there's a plan accompanying that legislation.
Yeah. Figure out how we're going to get there with a plan so that they're not arbitrary, right? So that it's factual.
And what if that plan includes some sort of device or some assessment to encourage people to use fewer carbon fuels? There's a proposal, the Transportation Climate Initiative, that folks think will add somewhere between 7 and 20 cents to a gallon of gas or heating oil, and that's a way to reduce consumption. We see that when oil prices go above $4 a gallon, usage goes down. So what about that approach?
What do those folks in the rural parts of our state do? It's not like they have a choice. If this TCI initiative that you're talking about was just in the greater Burlington area, just around that, it wouldn't affect as many people, or maybe affect more people, actually. But it wouldn't affect the economy like it would in the rest of the 11 to 13 counties surrounding Burlington. We have two different economies in Vermont, and that's I see it every day. I mean, it's quite different when you look at Lunenburg or Richford or wherever up in the Northeast Kingdom area, and compare that to Chittenden County. Vastly different economies. So a TCI, a tax mechanism, wouldn't affect Burlington like it would the rest of the state. And I'm very concerned about the rest of the state.
Could you see setting up legislation where there would be a TCI for Chittenden County?
Listen, I believe that in 20 years we're going to be at a place where we don't have these fuels being used. I'm thinking that these EVs will be common at that point. So if we count on this mechanism and tax fuel, or use a carbon tax or gas tax or whatever it is you want to call it, and we use this, and we have fewer vehicles on the road, fewer people using with gas, carbon-emitting vehicles, then where's the money going to come from? So some of these, I mean, this might sound good for Boston or Hartford or some of those largely populated areas, and maybe even Burlington. But for the rest of the rural parts of our state, I don't think it works for us, penalizing people.
One last thing. We're almost out of time. You've got the paid family leave bill sitting on your desk. All indications are that you're going to veto it. Isn't that the likely outcome?
I don't think anybody will be surprised by my action, but you'll find out by Monday what I've done.
But it's pretty likely you're going to do it, isn't it?
I don't think anybody's going to be surprised.
Well, there have been a lot of important issues for us to follow in the weeks ahead. Governor Phil Scott, many thanks for taking the time to be on the program today. We really appreciate it.
Thanks very much for having me on.